Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Lots to get done, right? So how was your weekend? Because the NBA's weekend was pretty awesome. In fact, if you get right down to it, it was an amazing weekend, an incredible weekend. Like, some entertainment over the weekend may have let you down, not the association. Not this past weekend. It not only lived up to the hype, it smashed it right up into 1,000 different pieces. Like, going into Friday night, there was the potential for 3 Game 7s yesterday. That ended, though, when the Warriors turned in one of the most brass performances you're ever going to see, and the Rockets did what the Rockets generally do. In fact, probably a good thing that there were not 3 Game 7s yesterday, because 2 was plenty. 2 was almost too many. That weekend was so good, so insane, it carried right over into Monday with this tweet from Woj. And I quote, Michigan's John Beilein has agreed to a 5-year deal to become coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, league sources tell ESPN. My response, the hell is that? John Beilein leaving Michigan, where he was killing it, where he turned Michigan into a basketball school. Even as Jim Harbaugh is the football coach. I mean, come on. Do we really look that stupid? John Beilein leaving for the association. Like, I saw that and I immediately thought, that's a prank. I had to check the Twitter handle to make sure that it wasn't Warj ESPN or Waj or Woj with a 0 instead of an O. But come to find out, that was a real Woj bomb. That's a real thing. John Beilein is leaving Michigan for the NBA. Now, normally news like that would lead this program. It would dominate the show. An icon of college coaching going to the NBA. Big swing by the Cavaliers to take a shot like that and not just go at the safe hire. I mean, I'm into that. I would have led the show with that. And it is a little bit shocking. Normally, I would still be tripping on that hire right now, but I'm not. I'm not because I still can't get beyond what went down in Toronto yesterday.
It's off to Leonard, defended by Simmons. Is this the dagger?
TNT. I mean, that is insane. Kawhi wins it with a buzzer beater in Game 7 with one of the most ridiculous shots you're ever going to see. Going to his right, getting enough space to get over Joel Embiid, and just enough on the ball to get it onto the rim where it stayed forever. You run that back. Run that back again and listen for the silence as the ball is on the rim until it finally does drop.
They get it to Leonard. Drives right. Down to the baseline, fall away for the win. Got it! It hit 4 rims and went down. Kawhi Leonard's shot went up in the air. It hit the rim. It bounced on the rim before going through the bucket. Toronto wins 92-90. It's on to Milwaukee. And the Eastern
that Conference bounce, though. I mean, honestly, if that shot was in a movie, you'd call bullcrap. Even in Hollywood, where we afford all incredible amounts of creative license, that shot wouldn't even fly there. There's no way a Game 7 comes down to a shot that bounces on the rim that many times and then falls. I mean, that's just too much. Even for Hollywood, the writers overcooked that. But it was real, and it did happen. It was insane. I mean, I could spend the entire show just playing that clip and the reaction shots from around the world, like the one from the Raptor fans outside the arena. That was solid gold. The first Game 7 walk-off in NBA history. And I'm not sure what's more unreal, that nobody had ever had a Game 7 walk-off in NBA history, or that shot was the one that did it, the one that bounced around on the rim forever. And it came just moments after Jimmy Butler had done this.
As the crowd quiets, they're on their feet here at Scotiabank Arena. The second free throw is no good. It's tipped. The ball is picked up by the Sixers. Harris on the move to Butler. Jimmy drives. It goes in. It's a layup. It's gone with 4 seconds to go. Timeout Toronto, and we're tied at 90.
Sixers radio. My man Buckets. attacking the bucket. How did he get that in past Serge Ibaka? In any other game, in any other world, that's the shot we're talking about right now. You hit that, you tie it up, you go on, you win in overtime. And then Philly is a team of legends, but the Claw ripped that from them. Can you run it back for me one more time?
It's off to Leonard, defended by Simmons. Is this the dagger?
Well, hell yes, that was the dagger. The ultimate dagger. So Dame gave us the wave in the first round. Kawhi gave us the squat in the second round. That photo of him squatting down, watching the shot, with Joel watching, and the entire world watching, that was like a freaking Renaissance painting. It's amazing. And again, what's insane about that shot is not the fact that it bounced around about a billion times, or that it somehow fell through. It's that Kawhi had been leaving his shots short all game. And let's be real. When he let that one go, it didn't look like it was going in. And that's not just me. A number of his teammates said the exact same thing, including Fred VanVleet, who was on the bench. He said, quote, "From that angle where we were at, it didn't look like it was going in at all at first. It looked like it was a little to the left. Once it sat on the rim for a second, we started to wait for it to just drop. Once it hit the rim once and twice, it was like, this is Kawhi. This is going to fall, and it did." End quote. Well said. This is Kawhi. And one more thought about Kawhi. This is something for all of you who doubted Kawhi. You know, if you thought that he was just some quiet guy with a weird laugh, or a weird guy with a weird laugh, if that's what you thought, and the only thing you thought about this guy, then that's on you. You forgot about Kawhi. You forgot that he's a Finals MVP. You forgot he's a two-time first-team All-NBAer, a two-time Defensive Player of the Year. You forgot the guy was banged up, and then he got healthy, and now he's back to doing what he always did in the past, killing people and killing narratives. You know that narrative about the Raptors being soft, the Raptors disappearing in the postseason. Yeah, Kawhi buried all of that in this series. 41 points, 8 boards, 3 assists in a Game 7. The list of active NBA players who have scored 40 or more in a Game 7 is as follows. Kawhi Leonard, LeBron James, and nobody else. Kawhi Leonard and LeBron James. Here's another one. Kawhi scored 243 points in that series against Philadelphia, the most in a single series since Michael Jordan in 1993. When asked about that, LeBron said, LeBron James and Michael Jordan, that's what you just witnessed. And just for the record, the Raptors did not need yesterday to win the trade. They traded DeMar DeRozan, Jakob Poeltl, and a protected first-round pick for Kawhi. That gave them flexibility going forward and a chance to re-sign a perennial MVP candidate. And they got Danny Green, and they got $5 million. That's how good Masai Ujiri is. Thanks, Alvin. Good looking out. So was there a risk? Yes. Was it a gamble? No. Because Masai knew he had to do something. He had to change it up. He had to break up something that was good in order to be great. And yesterday was great, cuz. Thank you, Alvin. Again. So now what do we have? We have Kawhi v. Giannis. The Claw v. the Freak. And what we already had was great, and it just got better. As for the Sixers, who were built to win right now, they're going to have a long, difficult summer with a number of difficult decisions to make. When asked for his reaction, LeBron said, Somebody might want to tell Kawhi that he just hit one of the biggest shots in NBA history.
I'm a guy that acts like I've been there before. So probably the last time you probably see me scream is like when we won. So whenever it's like a moment where I haven't really experienced, I'll probably try to give some emotion, show some emotion, and let it just come out. So, you know, tonight was one of those nights.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in-store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. Ben Golliver is back for more. Ben, hope you had a great weekend. Nice to have you. How are you?
I had a great weekend. Usually I can guess where you want to start, but man, there's stories everywhere in the NBA.
Well said, Ben. Extremely well said. Why don't we start here? What was going through your head on that final play of the Sixers-Raptors game as Kawhi Leonard got the ball?
Well, I knew he wasn't going to pass, that's for sure, because he's been their offense basically the entire playoffs, a one-man wrecking crew. I thought Philadelphia honestly defended it great. You see Joel Embiid jump out, basically to double-team him, kind of having the same thought I had, which is, look, Kawhi's going to want to have this game in his hands. You know, Kawhi kept working to his spot, got a pretty clean look, elevated really high, shot the ball high, and he got the friendliest of four bounces I think I've ever seen on a game winner, kind of at any level in any situation. For that to be the very first ever Game 7 game-winning buzzer-beating shot in NBA history was incredible, and you could just tell how relieved and excited that Toronto fan base has. Look, that's why you trade for him. I mean, they swung big last summer, breaking up their core, shipping DeMar DeRozan to the San Antonio Spurs to get a guy who'd been in the finals, been a finals MVP, is a legit number one option who's trustworthy in the postseason. They got him in Kawhi Leonard, and he delivered.
Well, what a major, major swing that was by Masai Ujiri. So what about the game overall, Ben, in terms of Kawhi Leonard? I mean, he got that ball. You knew he was going to shoot it. But what do you make of that Game 7 performance overall that he had?
Boy, it was ugly, man. We're starting to see some of these teams running out of gas late in those series because they were just in dogfights. I mean, it was a defensive battle, kind of both ways. I think the big question for Toronto going forward is, of the four teams who are remaining in this postseason, they had the worst offense so far, during the playoffs. And they're going up against the Milwaukee Bucks defense that has been the best defense in these playoffs. So they're going to have to diversify their offensive approach. And, Kawhi Leonard was able to pull them through that Game 7. I think he had 41 of their 92 points, something ridiculous like that. That formula will not work against Milwaukee. They're going to need to get more scoring, more outside shooting from Kyle Lowry. They're going to need Marc Gasol to be a more willing shooter. You're seeing time and again he's passing up shots in these postseason. That's really not going to cut it for the Raptors. They're just going to need to get offense and scoring from, lots of different options. Because if you look at the Bucks, they've got some pretty good perimeter defenders, whether it's Chris Middleton, Giannis. They have some different looks they can throw on Kawhi. I'm sure they're going to be focusing a lot of their defensive attention on him. And it's really going to be on the Raptors supporting cast to step up if they want to go to the finals.
Ben Golliver joining us. All right, Ben, what about Philadelphia? They got off to a slow start yesterday. They battled all the way back. They tied Game 7 on the road with just over 4 seconds left. What do you make of how they played overall in the postseason, and then where do they go from here?
Man, Jim, it's so funny you asked that question because the whole playoffs, I'm thinking, look, if these guys don't make the conference finals, Elton Brand is going to get crushed for those trades he made during the season. Those are all-in trades to get Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris. You're getting rid of all these draft picks, rotation players, guys who you're kind of mortgaging your future to win now. So if you don't win now, that's going to blow up in his face. I don't know about you, though. They fought so well in that series. They pushed it so far in Game 7. They lost in such heartbreaking fashion that now almost my mind kind of flipped the other direction. It's like, well, maybe he's going to get off scot-free here. Maybe they're going to say, all right, well, pay Jimmy, take a look at paying Tobias, who maybe was a little bit quieter during this postseason, and just try to run it back next year with the same group. I think the big undoing for the Sixers was just the inconsistency from Joel Embiid. Unfortunately for him, the illnesses, the knee stuff, those popped up at the worst possible moment and really prevented the Sixers, I think, from being their best selves, being their most stable selves. And I think Brett Brown put it really well after the game. He said, look, this is going to be a learning experience. Speaking about Joel Embiid, because obviously he was in tears after that game. This is going to be something he can look back on later in his career as kind of a formative experience of getting over the hump. And I think that's true. So to me, I expected if they went out early in the first or second round of the playoffs, there would be major sweeping changes in Philadelphia this summer. Now I'm not so sure. Now I wouldn't be surprised at all if they do whatever they can to keep Jimmy Butler and then just keep this thing going.
I would. I would. That's how I'd handle that. Ooh. Ben Golliver joining us. I would. I thought they played hard. I thought they showed some grit. I thought they showed some heart. And you're right. I mean, they didn't get the best from Joel Embiid. It's too bad that he was busted up and sick when he was. But I would try and keep that thing together. So, Ben, where do you come out on the Blazers? They're going to the conference finals for the first time since 2000. But they came from down 17 on the road to beat Denver. And they did it on a night where Damian Lillard had an off game in terms of shooting. How impressed were you with what you saw from them?
Well, one thing I know about the Blazers fans is the undying optimism because they've been through so much. And I'll bet you there's some people out there, Jim, who the day after Jusuf Nurkić broke his leg, they probably went to Vegas and bet on the Blazers making the Western Conference final because I'm sure the odds were just crazy. And somebody's cashing checks somewhere in the Rip City. You know, I'm sure about that one. It was a wild run. That series had so many twists and turns. I mean, Portland wins game three and four overtimes. Denver comes right back and punches them in the mouth with what I thought was the most impressive win of the whole playoffs, with that game four victory on the road. And yet Portland doesn't break. They don't crack. They stick together. You know, clearly CJ McCollum was the one who stepped up for Portland in game seven. I mean, he was just masterful one-on-one, getting to his spots, hitting jumpers, just reliable time and time again, cool, calm, and collected under the pressure, which is what you like to see. But, you know, they're going from the short end of the pool to the deep end of the pool here against Golden State. If you look at the playoffs the last couple of years, Golden State has been 8-1 against Portland head-to-head. They've, you know, dominated the Blazers during the regular season during the Steve Kerr era, which is no big surprise considering the amount of talent the Warriors have. So they were able to lean on their experience, their willpower to kind of get past Denver. But against Golden State in the Western Conference Finals, that's not going to be enough. I mean, their formula for an upset here, I mean, they've got to hope Kevin Durant's injury, you know, just drags longer than expected. They've got to hope they can get the two best weeks of basketball that Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum have ever played. And then they've got to find a third source of offense. Now, whether that's Enes Kanter in the middle, you know, doing his thing like he has in this postseason, whether that's one of the shooters, you know, Al-Farouq Aminu or Mo Harkless, these guys who really have not stepped up at all in the postseason, you know, finally finding their stroke and you know, providing some balance offensively. But their main guards are going to need more help than they've gotten if they want to have any chance against Golden State.
Ben Golliver joining us for a few more moments. All right, Ben, so what about Golden State? For instance, if I told you before game six against Houston that Durant would not play and that Steph Curry would not score in the first half, what kind of a game would you have expected?
That was a wild game. I mean, Houston should have won that game by 20 points, honestly. They just did not come out and put the Warriors away early. Their opportunity was the first half, just like you mentioned. There's no doubt about it. And as painful as those 27 missed threes in a row were last year in Game 7, I honestly think that first half could be even more painful because it was right there for the taking. And the only guy for Golden State who had anything going was Klay Thompson, and the Rockets should have been able to put them away, and they just weren't able to do it. Now, that second half by Steph was truly special. To me, that was his moment of truth, right? I mean, Kevin Durant's not out there. All these people are chirping about, does he come up short in the playoffs? He doesn't have that signature moment. He hasn't won a finals MVP. I mean, all those kinds of questions that have sort of been in the background for Steph Curry were starting to rise as he's going scoreless in the first half, getting into foul trouble, and Steve Kerr turning to him during a huddle and saying, how can I trust you not to get your third foul? I mean, that is pointed, you know, criticism and questioning from your own coach. For Steph Curry to turn that around with a 33-point second half, 23 points in the fourth quarter, to seal it up with the three-pointer from the right wing and all those free throws late was just incredible. To me, that was the single best postseason moment of his entire career, and he's had a lot of them. And I think that gives them a lot of momentum here going into the Western Conference Finals as they wait to see when Durant comes back.
Very high praise. Ben Golliver joining us. Ben, one last thought. If you're Houston then, and you thought that last year you were robbed by the refs and by the fact that Chris Paul was injured, and then this year you're eliminated at home by Golden State, a Warriors team without Kevin Durant, what kind of thoughts are you having right now, and then where do you go from here?
Well, look, Jim, I mean, they're dark thoughts, right? I mean, that was a heartbreaking, crushing loss. So there's no question about it. I mean, they spend so much mental energy preparing for the Golden State Warriors. They got a great shot and some lucky breaks with Durant's injury and Steph being in some slumps. They defended Steph very well all series long. I mean, to me, if I'm the Rockets, I'm looking at that and thinking, you know what? That was our best shot with this group. I don't think we're going to be able to do better than that. And so that means you have to assess all options this summer. To me, the one person I'd be circling would be Chris Paul. You know, it's not fun to say, hey, trade a Hall of Famer. You don't want to disrespect him. He had a great game seven and a really impressive bounce back from injury during the regular season. But it's much like Kawhi Leonard in Toronto, like I was saying earlier. Harden needs more help. They have to balance their offense a little bit better. It can't just be on his shoulders, because you're not going to beat three or four or five Hall of Famers with just one guy. That's not going to work. And I think Harden needs a more stable, consistent number two player. I think if you could find a way to trade Chris Paul, maybe free up a little bit of flexibility on your salary cap and retool that way, that would be one option I would be looking at if I was the Houston Rockets.
And that's how you recap an amazing NBA weekend with Ben Golliver, Washington Post national NBA writer, co-host of Open Floor Podcast, a Jungle legend. My man, that is such good stuff. Really appreciate that, Ben. Thank you very much.
It's always my pleasure, Jim. Take care, man.
That Laker fan protest that I previewed on Friday, and I don't want to get to the hiring of the new head coach until I get to the Laker fan protest. Let's close the book on that thing. That was so much more pathetic than I could have ever imagined. Did I have to talk about that first? Quickly, let me reset for anybody who missed it. This past Friday, I talked about a scheduled protest that was happening at Staples Center. The protest was put on by some Reddit user who wanted disgruntled Laker fans to gather outside the arena and peacefully voice their displeasure with the dysfunction of the Laker front office. This guy told a local radio station that he thought the protest would probably bring out between 60 and 80 people. Between his announced RSVPs and the actual protest, I said on this show, remember, I said this, quote, "This is the most colossal waste of time I have ever heard of, and these idiots are going to make the LeBron mural vandalizers look good by comparison." Well, as always, I'm here to own it and admit I was wrong, because it was far more pathetic than even I could have forecasted. Turns out the predicted showing of 60 to 80 people was a little bit too high, like 45 people too high. And by all accounts from Twitter and the assembled media, there were more statues in Star Plaza than actual protesters. So what do you do when only 14 people show up to bring down an entire organization? If it were me and I were one of the 14, I'd keep right on walking. I'd pretend that I was in the area for something else and that I was not one of the 14. I would take one look at that pathetic turnout and head the opposite way and act like I was never stupid enough to attend in the first place. Unfortunately, that is not what happened. Instead, the protest got underway. It carried on. And it got started with an earth-shattering chant from six dudes whose voices reverberated throughout the entire Southland.
No more Rambis! 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 No more Rambis!
Now, what do you think when you hear that? Like, sounds like one guy chanting, "No more Rambis, no more Rambis." What is that? I'll tell you what that is. That's the sound of anger. That's the sound of discontent. That's the sound of change. Yeah, just kidding. That's the sound of six morons who carried a chant eight times before flaming out. Yeah, right about now, I sure hope that Linda or Kurt, or whoever the hell that was directed at, I hope they're all right, because that was a savage takedown. Can't imagine that felt very good, to watch a group of people who couldn't even field a baseball team just tearing you apart like that. And then there was this Laker bro on KCAL 9, who didn't just want Rambis gone, he wanted everybody gone.
"We want a star. We want another star free agent.
How about Kyrie Irving?
KD?
I want Kyrie Irving.
Who do you want fired?
We want to fire everyone who's making this organization not get to the playoffs."
Now, there's some logic. That's pretty rational. The logic of a Laker bro demanding everybody be fired because he wants another superstar. Bro, free agency is not officially started yet. You can't just add another superstar. And that 35 mil that's burning a hole in your pocket, what good is having 35 mil if nobody wants it? But stay hot, Laker bro. Stay hot. Then there was this guy who made an extremely compelling argument that he's next in the family line to get a championship, that he, in fact, is entitled to a championship because everybody else in his family who matters has their own already.
My uncle had Magic. My brother had Kobe. I have LeBron. What's he brought me? Nothing. I want rings.
My uncle had Magic. My brother had Kobe. I have LeBron. What's he brought me?
My uncle had Magic. My brother had Kobe. I have LeBron. What's he brought me? Nothing. I want rings.
Boy, look at the entitlement of that Laker bro. My uncle had Magic. My brother had Kobe. My dog had Rick Fox. My driver's ed teacher had Derek Fisher. My Yogurtland cashier had Andrew Bynum. My babysitter had Kwame. Settle down, bro. No one cares about your 23andMe DNA report. I'm 4.5% Clipper and 17% Laker. Man, nobody cares. You're only getting on camera. You're only getting FaceTime because there's like 50 news reporters and they can't come back with nothing. 50 news reporters and 14 people to interview, man. Chill the hell out. But that star of the show was without question the dude who rolled in a suit with his face painted, half purple, half yellow, and his hair up in a man bun. Man, style points for days. There's business casual, and then there's business Braveheart. And this guy looked like your IT dude from the neck down, but William Wallace from the neck up. It was an amazing look. The only thing better than his look was his actual take.
First things first, fire everyone. Second thing, get all the best players back.
First things first, fire everyone. Second thing, get all your best players back. Look the hell out, Rob Pelinka. My man's Danny Ainge, Bob Myers, Pat Riley, Jerry West, Daryl Morey, all rolled into one. Logic like that, fire everyone, get all the best players back. Right, bring them all back. Irv, Kobe, the Logue, Ream, Gasol, bring them all back. But only after you fire everybody first. You tell them, Braveheart. Friend of the program. So maybe you think this is just me killing these guys for no reason. All right, go to a higher authority than me. Good friend of the program. Arash Markazi. My man Arash published an article for the LA Times, and the headline screamed, Lakers fan protest, arguably a rock bottom moment for storied franchise. A rock bottom moment or the rock bottom moment? That should give you some idea of how things went on Friday. Twitter also, and if Twitter says so, it must be so. Twitter also dubbed it the most pathetic protest in the history of protests. So far, no word from Jeannie Buss if she was moved to sell the team. But they did hire Frank Vogel. So maybe that protest worked? Kinda? Sorta? Not really? The losers of the event are all 14 morons that showed up for it. The winners are everybody in the world that didn't. May we never, ever have to spend this much time on a pathetic gathering of clowns ever again. And the only ones who look worse than those 14 losers is the organization that those 14 losers were trying to bring down.
My uncle had Magic. My brother had Kobe. I have LeBron. What's he brought me? Nothing. I want rings.
There's some pretty good logic. My uncle had Magic. My great-great uncle had Kareem. My great-great-great-great-grandfather had George Mikan. My dentist had Smush Parker. My apartment manager had Devin George. My high school counselor had Travis Knight. My chiropractor had Mark Madsen. And I have LeBron. What's that scrub brought me? Nothing, man.
Thank you.
Give me my freaking rings. Peace, I'm out. Let's go home and watch ourselves on the news. God, that was embarrassing. Clones, by now you probably figured this out. I am a paid professional. as a pro at keeping you clones in line and interviewing the right people in sports, here is some simple advice that can help you. When you're looking for pro tips on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. Whether it comes to replacing your battery, getting advice on proper car maintenance, or even just getting the best bang for your buck, their expert team can help you out every step of the way. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. John Urschel is my guest. Wow, John, that's quite an intro. Great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I have to say, that's the best intro I've ever gotten in my life.
My man, that's amazing. I appreciate you saying that. But then again, I've never spoken to anybody who had a resume quite like that. So why don't we jump in? You've published a couple of papers in academic journals, but you wrote this book with Louisa Thomas, and the book comes out tomorrow. So let me start right there, John. What's it like for the two of you today on the eve of this book going out into the world? Is it exciting? Is it nerve-wracking? Or is it something else?
Oh, we're just so excited. I mean, we put so much of ourselves in this, and we're really looking forward to it coming out and seeing how people like it. I mean, it's really my story, so you know, I'm very attached to it, and I hope people enjoy learning about my football experiences, but also my journey with mathematics.
Now, John, you've said that you initially wanted to write a book about math, but your publisher said that if you want to share your love of math and reach people at the same time, you can't only write about math. So how'd you go about approaching this project?
The way I approached it is really the way that my life worked when I was, you know, when I was playing football and doing math at the same time. It's sort of looking at these two seemingly disjoint things and how they relate and how I grew in both of these areas at the same time.
Now, your mother,
not one without the other, you know?
Right. I was going to say, John Urschel, my guest, your mother plays an enormous role in this story. She grew up in Cincinnati. Her father had a GED. Her mother stopped after middle school, but she went to college. How do you explain that, and what did you learn from her about having a vision and going after it?
First of all, she's my biggest role model in the world. Her, you know, like you said, her parents had to stop education early for real reasons. Her mother had to stop in the segregated South, and she decided that she wanted something better for herself, and she valued education. She was a good student, and that was such a great influence for me, because when I was growing up, my mother always told me that if I wanted to be great at something, if I wanted to do something, the only thing that would hold me back was either a lack of talent, a lack of work ethic, or bad luck. It would never be the household I was born into or the color of my skin. And she did a fantastic job raising me. She saw I was good at math, and she jumped on it.
John Urschel is a mathematician, also a former NFLer. Now, you made the point that your mom loved puzzles. She loved problem solving. So what was it like for you growing up as her son? How much did you get bitten by the puzzles and problem solving bug yourself?
Oh, I was bitten hard, man. I'm telling you. Like most kids, you know, for allowance, they're doing dishes, they're mowing the lawn. My form of allowance was doing math calculations in the grocery store.
Wow. That is different. That's great. Now, one of the things you've talked about is the fact that she wanted you to be an engineer. However, not just any kind of engineer, an aerospace engineer. Why was that the vision?
She wanted me to be a rocket scientist. I mean,
literally.
My mom, she didn't go into sort of a STEM field. And as far as she knew, in her mind, the most brilliant, amazing thing someone can do if they're good at math and physics is be a rocket scientist. And she thought this was the most amazing thing. When I got to college, I really found myself more fascinated with mathematics than engineering. I always found myself asking the question, why rather than how? And I have to say, I'm very happy with my choice.
John Urschel joining us. You know, John, we kind of touched on this, but that whole question or notion of nature versus nurture. And then you write this piece for the New York Times that when you were growing up, you thought that math class was something to be endured, and that a teacher told your mother that you were, quote, slow, and that you should repeat a grade. First of all, how is that even possible? And what were you like as a student when you were growing up?
Yeah, as a student, I was often disinterested in math class, mainly because, you know, I already knew all of it. And when I was very little, they thought I had a learning issue because I wasn't paying attention in class. I wasn't really answering questions. And they thought I had a mental disability. They wanted to hold me back a grade and put me in sort of a special class. So my mom forces them to test me, and my test scores are off the chart, and now all of a sudden they want to bump me up a grade. So,
all right, so then you that happens. You get to high school, and obviously at that point nobody's questioning your mathematical ability then, but at the same time, were they encouraging it? What was it like then?
In high school, first of all, I had great math teachers who, you know, they had a lot on their plate, but I would say that the type of encouragement I got on the football field, where I had my high school coaches telling me, John, you can play college football. John, you should aspire to be the best football you can be. I didn't quite have the same thing from my math teachers, although I had fantastic math teachers. I wish when I was younger, I would have even known what a mathematician was. As crazy as it sounds, I didn't even know what the profession of mathematician was until I got to college. It's hard to want to grow up to be something if you don't even know what that something is or what it looks like.
John Urschel joining us. So now you're talking math and you're talking football. What about football? How did you first get into football, and what did you like about it when you first started playing?
So the reason I started playing football is because my dad played college ball. He played at the University of Alberta, and when I was a kid, I would see photos of him from when he played. And so when I started playing, I absolutely fell in love with it. It turned out that, you know, although I didn't know any technique, you know, I was a little late to the game, I was good at hitting people, and I really liked it. And that goes a long way.
All right, so John Urschel joining us. And then you talked about you didn't understand mathematics per se, or at least the future of a mathematician when you were younger, but it started to change when you got to college. How much did your perception and understanding of mathematics change once you got to college? What was it like then?
It was like a complete 180. The way math is taught in college is very much asking why, asking about understanding, rather than sort of here's a formula, now let's use it 20 times and then do it on the exam. And I really enjoyed the idea of understanding why something is a certain way. And that's what I connected with. And once I got to college, my love of mathematics just grew and grew. And when I got to MIT, I think I loved math even more, if that was even possible.
And John, it's interesting because you and I are having this conversation, and I'm trying to find a way to have the conversation and talk about both of these things. I mean, it's not that hard, but we are talking about a couple of things, but you're actually living that life. And if you look at math and you look at football, it would seem like they're on parallel tracks, and you might be living almost a double life. Does it feel that way, or are these two things intertwined?
They definitely feel intertwined. I would say that anybody who's very, very good at two things, I think they'll tell you that the characteristics that make them good at one of the things is the same thing that makes them good at the other. A passion for what they're doing, a drive to be the best, and just an unwavering commitment to whatever your goals and dreams are.
All right, so when people look at you then, they're amazed that you're both an athlete and a mathematician at the highest levels. What do you make of that? For instance, does that feel like an honor, or is there a part of you that says everybody is constantly trying to divide the world into separate categories? Why is it so unusual to be an athlete and a mathematician?
So first of all, it's an honor for me to be able to sort of carry that banner, but I think it's not nearly as unusual as people think it is. I mean, Jim, you've been around NFL locker rooms. You've been around professional sports. There are smart people in professional sports, but you don't always hear about them.
No, it's true. It's not. It's almost made out to be like, John, it's like some intellectual wasteland. That's not the case at all. That's not the case. You don't always hear about them. So when you look at what you've accomplished then, both as an athlete and a mathematician, how much of that, and this goes back to what your mom said, I think, how much of that is about natural ability, John, and how much of that is about grit and toughness and needing both those things in both those fields?
I think you need both of those things. And I'll always be the first one to say I had way more potential in math than I did in football. I was an above average athlete, but I had to work so hard to get where I got to in football, whereas in math, I think it came a lot easier.
Did you have a greater passion for either one, or was it just different?
I think it changed from time in my life. In high school, I have to say I was way more passionate about football. In college, when I was at Penn State, both were very equal. By the time I got to MIT, I have to say, math really started winning out.
John Urschel joining us for a few more moments. You know, I'm kind of curious, like my son, John, I've got a senior in high school who was, you know, just an average athlete, but he worked really, really hard at it. But he had AP classes and he played baseball. And it always seemed like the coaches didn't really understand the AP classes because it took them away from baseball. And the teachers don't really understand the athletic commitment because the time in the gym took them away from academics. What about your two? Did the two sides understand each other as you were coming up?
Yeah, I think I was really lucky. Okay, in high school, I don't think they understood each other the best. But when I was in college, the Penn State football team, they understood that academics mattered, and they cared about it, and they actually took pride in the things I did with respect to academics. And my math teachers, my professors, they understood that I was doing something really cool on the football field, And they were aware of it, and they respected it as well.
All right, so the book drops tomorrow. Let me quickly ask you this. When you retired from football in 2017, it's the same question, John, of any great athlete. How do you know? And most times you don't know, or you don't want to be told. You just want to make sure you go out on your own terms. But how did you know that you were ready to walk away and that that was the right time?
Yeah, it's a tough question to know when, and you can never be sure. But, you know, I had a child coming who's now 16 months old, and I love spending time with her. Things at MIT were really heating up, and I found that I just asked myself, what are the things in this world that I'm most passionate about right now and I'm most excited about? And they were mathematics and raising my daughter and being able to do both of these things for a long time.
You know, you kind of answered my next question, because the answer would be both, but I was going to say, you have an amazing mind. So how much of your decision to walk away from your sport was about protecting your brain, and how much of it was about your family and your future?
I think they're all intertwined. I think making decisions about spending more time with my daughter, or being able to sort of run around with my daughter when I'm 60, or run around with my grandkids, or to be able to, you know, still walk and still be able to sort of teach math when I'm 60, all of these things are sort of intertwined. And I'm so blessed to have been able to play 3 years in the league, had amazing experiences, start and play playoff games, you know, against the Patriots, against the Steelers, but also be extremely healthy when I retire.
So, John, one more thought. When Josh Rosen, for instance, was coming out of UCLA last year, one of the raps, one of the knocks on him as a player was, it's incredible to me, but that he might be too smart. What do you make of that? Is there any way that being too smart is a bad thing for a football player?
I mean, I don't know about too smart, but I have to, you know, I have to admit that when I came out, people were concerned because I had this other thing I was very good at and very passionate about. And in hindsight, I think it's fair. You know, teams are investing millions and millions of dollars into people. They want to make sure that this is like the main thing that someone's doing. And oftentimes, if football is all someone has, if they don't have anything else, even if they don't have a college degree, there's no question that this person has to do football. And that assurance is, you know, is something that I think teams appreciate.
I would like to reiterate that my guest is a mathematician, a retired NFL player, a two-time first-team All-Big Ten player at Penn State, a doctoral candidate in applied mathematics at MIT, and the author of a book. It's called Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football. It comes out tomorrow. John, what is the best way for our listeners to find that book?
Go to your local bookstore. It'll be in stores tomorrow, or just go to Amazon.com and just type in Mind and Matter, A Life in Football, and just click that little order button. It'll be there in 2 days.
Once again, Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football. It does come out tomorrow. Look for that. John Urschel, my guest. John, great to get caught up. Good luck with that book. I hope we can talk again soon. That was a lot of fun.
Much appreciated.
Nebraska head football coach Scott Frost is my guest. You know, Scott, in terms of that process, I wonder how much of that, the thing we're talking about right now, was on your mind when you came back to Nebraska and you made the walk-on program a priority once again?
Well, the walk-on program was a big part of what Coach Devaney and Coach Osborne built here. We're going to do everything we can to get the majority of that back. I think it'll be another year or so before we really start to see the benefits of it. But, you know, we're not just taking walk-ons just to be out at practice and be scout team guys for us. We're going to develop them the same way that we try to develop our scholarship guys. And a lot of those guys are going to end up being players and starters for us down the road. So there's a lot of good players in Nebraska. There's a lot of good players in the Midwest. We've gotten a bunch of those guys to come walk on, and they're in the weight room and on the field working right now. It won't be very long before those guys are helping us win games.
Scott Frost joining us. So, Scott, last season didn't get off to the start that you would have liked, but you won four of your last six, and two games that you lost were by single digits on the road at Ohio State and Iowa. So how much did the team and the program grow over the course of that last season?
You know, growth is the right word for it. Rome, we had a lot of growth that we had to go through to get where we wanted to get. We're still not there, but I saw a transformation on the team as the year went along. We couldn't have beat almost anybody in the country at the beginning of the year because we were going to find a way to beat ourselves or to give up the plays that we couldn't give up if we wanted to win. By the end of the year, we were battling and playing together and loving each other and kind of had the culture built that we're looking for, and that led to a lot of close games and some that we won and some more that we could have won. I think the encouraging thing for me is, you know, Ohio State was a great team, and we played them close certainly had every chance to beat Northwestern. Those two teams were in the Big Ten championship. We were nowhere near where I want to be as a football program last year, and by the end of the year, we were still competitive with the best teams in this league. So I think that's a sign that there's good things to come.
Scott Frost joining us. Something else that you didn't mention, but I will. You averaged nearly 37 points per game over the final six, and you had seven straight games of 450 yards or more, which was a first in school history. So the foundation is being built. Now, when you mention culture, man, Scott, that comes up with almost every single coach I talk to on this program now, regardless of sport, it always comes up. How would you define the culture that you want to see in your program?
You know, it does. I think coaches talk about it probably too much, and it gets to be cliche, but it's true. If you got the right type of attitudes in your locker room and on the field, it's going to lead to wins. If you don't have it, it really doesn't matter how much talent you have. If I really had to summarize what we're trying to build here, it's that I want our kids to feel like they're part of something that's bigger than themselves. Life, football, everything's about sacrifice. It's not about what can I get for me. It's about how can I contribute to a team or something that's bigger than myself. And if we get a bunch of guys thinking and doing things with that type of attitude and the team in mind first, we're going to win more games than we're going to lose.
So any idea, how long does that take, and are you starting to see that culture take root?
Yeah, it really flipped last year about midway through the season. We lost a tough game to Purdue. I had several of the team leaders and captains come up into my office right after that game and tell me they were going to demand change. And really that's when everything flipped. I think in the locker room, the kids that wanted to do things the right way and that group started to win out over the group that was resisting. And that's really when we became a better team and were competitive in our league. And we've just been upward and onward from there. You're never all the way there with culture. It's constant gardening. It's stuff you have to do every day, just like parents have to try to teach their kids something new every day and keep them moving in the right direction. It's something we're always working on, but we're in a lot better place right now than we were 12 months ago.
Scott Frost joins me for a couple of more moments. So, Scott, when you were at UCF, the team made a huge breakthrough in the second season. I understand that every single situation is totally different, but when you look back at UCF, what signs did you see that a breakthrough was about to take place, and are you seeing any of those same signs at Nebraska right now?
Yeah, it's very similar tracks, Rome. It's interesting as you're trying to build a program. We really didn't know that success was going to come and didn't feel it coming until probably fall camp of that second year. Some pieces fell right for us. Some things happened that we needed to have happen to have a complete team. And everything just took off from there. We really thought down there it was going to be a three-year deal. We thought in our third year, which would have been last season, that was going to be our year, and things just happened a little quicker than we thought. But we're looking for a jump this year. I know there's a lot of high expectations outside of the program. There's a lot of high expectations in this building for what we can accomplish. We got some of the right pieces. We're certainly not a complete team yet, but we're way down the road from where we were 12 months ago, and I would love to see the same type of leap forward happen in year two here.
Scott Frost, my guest. Scott, earlier this year, your outside linebackers coach, Jovan DeWitt, was diagnosed with throat cancer. What was your reaction when you heard that news, and how have you and the players rallied around him?
You know, he's just starting to get back involved again. He was in my office this morning. Things look like they're going really well for him. So, you know, our prayers are with him, and we're going to do everything we can for him. You know, one of the first messages, I learned this from Tony Dungy, one of the first messages I give the team every year is we all love football and football is important, but football isn't life. And when things like this happen, it helps you realize that there's as much time as we spend on football and trying to win games, it's not the most important thing. And I think when you're coming from that point and you understand that, I think it makes you even better player, even better coach, and even better team. So we're going to try to keep our priorities in place, and trying to help Jovan through this is certainly something that's going to keep us grounded.
Scott Frost, my guest. And a final thought, Scott. I mean, nobody knows that program, I don't think, like you know that program. You played there. You starred there. You know the state. You know everything involved. Is there, now that you're in this thing for like a year plus, is there anything maybe now that you know about the job that maybe you didn't know when you first got back?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I saw how the program was run when it was run the right way, and we were winning. And to be honest with you, I didn't know how far from that it had gone. We've got it back on the right railroad tracks, and we're covering some ground here. But a lot of the things that I loved about the program are still the same. The people of Nebraska are its best asset. The type of help that you get, the type of support we have here, the type of resources we have here, that's all in place. So it's just up to us to start running the program in a lot of the same ways that it was run for 30 years when Nebraska was winning games at a clip that nobody else in the country could match.
It's a great state. It's a great program. Scott Frost is the head coach. He's entering his second season there. He was the 2017 National Coach of the Year. They wrapped up last season by winning four of their last six. They open up this season, August 31st, against South Alabama. Scott, I appreciate you and the conversation as always. Thanks so much.
Man, always great to be on. Good luck.
Let's go to Buffalo. My man, Rick, what's going on?
Everything's going great, Jim. How are you doing?
So good, Rick. Perfect.
Well, I saw Stucknut posted his smack-off odds the other night, and obviously that dope knows nothing about the show. He's got those two Canadian lames going off at 10-1. I wouldn't touch those hacks at 100-1. I've already referenced how pathetic Matt's top 10 list was last year. But Tyler's fit alarm gimmick doesn't get nearly the ridicule it deserves. That thing went over like a wet fart at a funeral. Cue that thing up, Alvy. Clones need to be reminded how historically terrible it was. Now I realize you feel pity for Canada, Jim, so I know you're going to take their smack-off calls, but could you kindly take them back-to-back at the bottom of hour two? That'll give me a chance to drop a nice mid-show deucer and restock the cooler without missing a friggin' thing. And I couldn't believe Caleb in Green Bay opened at 5-1. That's a bigger stretch than that doughboy trying to squeeze into a pair of size 48 Levi's. You got no shot, Webb. Maybe you should just bring your mom on again this year, fat boy. And she can apologize for being such a failure as a parent. In summary, Jim, the Stucknut smack-off odds are a complete friggin' joke. And it's no surprise when you consider the source. As a favor to the clones, I'll be tweeting out the real smack-off odds a little later in the show. War John Beilein getting a huge payday. He's definitely earned it. War Steve Kerr being just like me, an effing giant who's mastered his craft. Thanks for the vine, Jim. I'm out.
Rock him! Thanks, Rick! He just gets stronger throughout the call. I feel like sometimes, like that time I was at the Super Bowl, you know that time, last year, I was sick as a dog. Mark in Boston. Mark, what's going on, man? How are you?
What's up, Jim? No time for formalities. Hey, Rick, you're absolutely right, man. The odds are off. Your dumbass is too high on the list. Quantity has never been better than quality, dude. Ask the Canadians. Jimmy, I got a hit on John Beilein. Super bummed to hear the coach is moving on to the NBA. I mean, it would be really bad if, like, someone had a tattoo of the guy on his arm or something. That would be really embarrassing. But, hey, HBO, way to get one of the most remarkable and wanted figures for a cameo and have it land flat on its face. No, I'm not talking about Left blowing up that absolute layup with Larry Brown. I'm talking about blowing up, literally, Aaron Rodgers on Game of Thrones. Good job, guys. Speaking of the odds, Jim, a couple things stick out. First, Caleb in Green Bay has the third highest odds to win at plus 500. It's not very nice, Steve. If you're going to make a joke about the dude's weight, at least make it accurate, like plus 325 or something. Hashtag fat. And I know his good brother Carl is in the field. Carl, how in the world will you ever compete in a contest where you need a fake tough guy voice, have to role play, and even though the winner is predetermined, cough, Brad. Speaking of Brad, good bro, you're really going to get along with Brad. You both shave your entire body, slip into barely fitting underwear, and have dudes all over you. My point is, Carl, you're going to do just fine. We may not have Macho Man Randy Savage, but we do have Nacho Man, Caleb in Green Bay, a.k.a. The Bundertaker. But that guy's never wrestled in his life, so no worries there. We don't have a dude in the field named The Rock, But we've got a guy like Nooch from Arkansas that looks like he smokes them. We do have a couple of good brothers, those two losers, the Datolas. I mean, they haven't been relevant in 20 years, but neither is the WWE, so I digress. Jim, every wrestler has their own finishing move, so I'm going to go ahead and RSVP here. Jim, you can officially count me in for the smack off, okay? And Jimmy, let me tell you something. On June 21st, the whole field is getting into a cage match with your boy. You hear that, Nacho Man? You hear that, B-I-T-C-H in Corona? Midwest Mafia, I'm taking all you clowns down. Rack me, Jim. I'll be there. Yeah.
I'll do it. Rack him, Alvy. John in New York. John, my brother, what's up? How are you?
Jim, how's it going? You're absolutely right. It's a culture, it's a family, and if people want to get down, they got to listen. Simple as that.
That's it. That's it. You
Jim,
know it.
No, there's no place I'd rather be, because after that brick was released from Kawhi, when he knelt in the corner, he had like a remote. Four bounces later, the fans go berserk, and Joel turns into Jeff in San Antonio. And I felt bad for Joel for a second, and then I thought about how he trolled, him and Ben trolled the Nets, and I said to myself, karma's a bitch. And then when I heard the news about John Beilein break, the only thing I thought about was great. I said, at some point between 12 and 3 today, I got to hear Rick and Buffalo going to labor with a take on how John Beilein is all this and all that, and Central New York this and Buffalo that, and junior colleges this. And I wasn't looking forward to it. But, Jim, someday when egos and images subside, you'll get your just due, because this show deserves to be on the radio in New York. Jim, wore the solar eclipse in the control room when James Kelly sits in front of the new guy on Fridays. And thanks for your time, Jim. I'm out.
My man, you rack John. I don't play favorites. Just rack him and do it now. I can't lie to you. I would very much like to be on in New York.
Good night.